Hello and welcome back to The Brave Front, the men's mental health podcast where we share real-life stories of inspiration, courage and adventure from people who have overcome adversity and defied the odds to achieve their dreams. My name's Tim Bainan, and if you haven't done so already, please follow us on your usual podcast platform. And if you want to, please leave us a review so others in need of a little mental strength can find us. And although we'll be taking a little break after this, the last episode of the season, we'd still love to hear from you if you've got an inspirational story to share about men's mental health. All the links you need are in the show notes. So, what's coming up in episode 15? Well, here's a taster as we meet Mark Agnew, European Adventurer of the Year.
There was one day where I really thought, like, God, this is selfish what I've done, because we almost died. And, you think about, it's like, you don't know how close you are, almost dying, but two bits of ice, like, slammed into either side of my kayak. Instead of crushing us, it picked us up. And who knows if it had been slightly heavier, or we'd leaning to the right or the left, or leaning forward, or put an arm out instinctively, that kind of thing. It could have just crushed us and powdered us. So much of my self-worth had become tied up in the idea of being an adventurer that I just re-examined my conversations with friends, and were they bored with me? Was I speaking too much? That's that kind of social anxiety that you get. I had that in the extreme, because I was just so worthless. I couldn't imagine my friends seeing worth in me. When we first opened the zip, I put the flare gun out of the tent, so it was right next to his head. We'd fired flares in the air for polar bears before, and they'd turn tail and run. And this gun went off next to its head, boom, flash of light, flare flies into the sky, and just completely unbothered. I started to cry and cry, my shoulders shaking with tears, trying to say to Eileen, we've done it. I just couldn't speak. I was crying so much. It meant so much to me. I thought of my wife, thought of everything it had taken me to get to the start, everything we'd been through together, and the pressure. And I thought about players at Wimbledon hitting their winning shot and then collapsing onto the grass and sobbing as they realised they won Wimbledon. It felt like that.
Writing your name in history books as one part of the first team to navigate the infamous Northwest Passage by human-powered kayak is a remarkable achievement, a true moment of personal triumph. And for Mark Agnew, it was exactly that. However, as he tells us in the interview you're about to hear, it was also far more than that. Having suffered with his own mental health following two failed attempts to row the Atlantic, the Northwest Passage was a chance for Mark to lay those demons to rest. But over the course of 103 days, it became about a deeper, more profound connection with his teammates and with the beauty of the Arctic Ocean. Now home and the proud owner of the title of European Adventurer of the Year, it was great to chat to Mark about life as an adventurer and the strength of teamwork. Mark, hello, welcome to the Brave Front. Thank you for joining us. It's great to see you. Got to tell me, first of all, where do we find the European Adventurer of the Year today? Where are you?
I'm down in London now. Yeah, I've lived here for a couple of years, but I'm from Edinburgh, despite my accent.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us today. Really great to see you. You won the title, of course, of being part of the first team to kayak the Northwest Passage. What does it mean to you to have achieved that title and to have broken two world records along the way?
It's a funny one, because it means a lot to me that I was part of this team, the Arctic Cowboys. And had this happened to me maybe 5, 6, 10 years ago, I would have said, I'm so proud to get these world firsts. I'm so overwhelmed by the feedback. I'm so, in awe of all of the media coverage and so honored to win European Adventure of the Year. But it took me time to realize that what it really means to me is the people that I did it with. As you say, I was one part of a team of four. West, Jeff, Eileen were the other three. And sooner or later, you realize that being an adventurer isn't defined by the final moment where you cross the finish line. It's defined by the experiences you have along the way and sharing those experiences with the people you have there with you. And if you only focus on that last minute and you think that somehow your life's going to be different the day that you pass the latitude that somebody has decided is the Northwest Passage or isn't the Northwest Passage, then you set yourself up for disappointment. But having those intrinsic motivators, they last with you, and they're far, far more powerful.
Yeah, I completely understand that. I want to talk about the team because I'm fascinated by that, because the team dynamic to do something so impressive that took such a long time, you've got to get on as a team. So I want to dig into that a little bit and find out a bit more about that. But the actual award, the European Adventure of the Year, was that for an individual, i.e. yourself, or was that for the whole team?
Well, the other three were Americans, so they weren't eligible. So I got it on account of being European, but you know, I wasn't the leader. That was West. I saw West was, I can't remember exactly what it was, but like Outdoorsman of the Year or second place in Outdoorsman of the Year for an American award. And Eileen and Jeff are, you know, not seeking the limelight in the same way that I am. So they haven't really, apart from a couple of local newspaper stories, haven't got the plaudits they deserve. So yes, I got it as an individual. Had the other three been Europeans, we would have got it as a team.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there you go. There you go. So they paid a price for living in America and not.
Yeah. 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 Have they not chosen to leave the British Empire, perhaps they would have.
Indeed.
They would have come under the umbrella.
Indeed. Yeah. But listen, tell us, for those of us whose kayaking experience goes no further than like an hour on the Basingstoke Canal, which is my extent of my experience.
Which is similar to what my, not too distant from my experience before I started the Northwest
Passage. Okay. So tell me, with that in mind, how big a challenge is the Northwest Passage? And well, first of all, where is it? And tell me a little bit about how extreme a challenge it is.
So the Northwest Passage is the Arctic route that links the Atlantic to the Pacific. And it is something that Britain in particular has been obsessed with for hundreds of years as maybe a shortcut to Asia. So in the 1570s was the first sort of explicit expedition to find it, because going around South America was past the Spanish colonies, around the Cape of Good Hope was via the Dutch colonies. Maybe we'd go via Canada, and then nobody would they'd care. And they found out that, well, for one, people do live there, the Inuit, and two, it's full of ice, and that made it a treacherous, treacherous place. But it captured Britain's imagination, and by the 19th century, they were sending expedition after expedition to find it, even long after it had become obvious that even if we did eventually stitch the route together, it wasn't going to be a viable trade route because it was taking years to get through, even just a few hundred miles. And then it really went into turbocharge in terms of a place in our imagination, where when John Franklin got trapped and they all died and they ate each other, and it's still, you know, it's the subject of a Michael Palin book from a couple of years ago. It's a subject of a BBC series called The Terror from a few years ago.
Oh, yeah,
it still holds sway. But what has happened in the last few years is the ice is disappearing. So for about 10 years now, the adventure community have sort of thought it's the next first. And a few people have tried it to be the first people to do it under human power, rowers, kayakers, some kind of hybrid boats. And even this year when we did it, there were two other rowing teams racing against us to be the first to do it under human power in a single season. And when I say the ice is disappearing, I don't mean it's gone. You know, even ice-free means 15% concentration or less. So we were trapped in ice, and the challenge was navigating through the ice, starting early enough in the season where there's ice is still there, but to give yourself enough time to get to the other end before winter arrives. And so you're in a constant race against time, not to mention...
So you're in a race against people, other people,
yeah,
and a race against Mother Nature as well. So
exactly. I guess the sort of convention was you have like 60 or so days. You know, you could start in early July and finish in early September. And everybody else had tried from the other end because it's further south. So you can start earlier with no ice. But then the problem is you start to go north when winter comes. So we decided to start from the other end, which meant we were further north, which meant the first, like, few hundred miles, ice was a constant threat. I mean, the first 100 miles took us like 3 weeks, you know, having been trapped for like 15 days. And the whole thing is almost 2,000 miles. So, but then when we got to the other end, the 60-day convention passed us by, and we ended up taking 103 days. So, and we were in October then, way beyond what people said we could be there. And I understand why, because it was absolutely savage for the last few days. You know, and if that had appeared 10 days earlier or 2 weeks earlier, as it may well have done any other year, then we could have been in a lot of trouble. But it was just a case of like holding on by our fingernails for the last few days as conditions turned from cold to freezing. And we saw bits of the ice, bits of the sea sort of turning to slush again, the beginnings of sea ice. So we saw it really like the whole cycle. So that's the challenge, is like trying to get through in a time frame without being, and you lose days. Or, in the first half we were kayaking, but a lot. And then in the second half, we came out of halfway. We had these six great days in a row. And then the subsequent 10 days, we only kayaked 2 out of 10 days because the weather was just deteriorating. So that's the challenge. It was cold, it was isolated. It had never been done, so there's no blueprint, and the winter is coming, as Jon Snow would say. And then you've got the other two teams sort of nipping at your heels as well. So yeah, there's a lot of things going on there.
Pretty challenging.
Yeah, I mean it was. but I guess on the other hand, like a kayak compared to rowing boats, is that we pulled up every night on shore and camped. So people would say, oh, wow, you must have been in extreme conditions. Well, no, apart from once in the last few hundred meters, where we found ourselves in breaking waves, we didn't go out in advanced conditions. As I said, it was 2 days of kayaking and 10 days of watching the water. It was more like the challenges would be the waiting game and the despondency of like watching time tick away and knowing that every day winter's coming closer or you're 1 day less food and whatnot. Yeah. Rather than say that the technical expertise of kayaking in like extreme conditions, because we wouldn't have gone out and then.
Plus, I imagine the remoteness as well. And then, the old polar bear on the horizon must have been a scary.
Well, the first half felt really remote. And of course, I've been places before where I couldn't see anyone, or I might have even been 2 days away from civilization, the Scottish Islands or Mongolia or something, but both places where I've felt that. But then there was something that like tapped into a primal part of your brain where you just have a innate awareness that this is really wild. There was a place called Prince Regent Inlet. I just remember looking out across the water and thinking, something about this place is bigger than I've been before. And although I can't see civilization, and I also can't see civilization from the top of Ben Nevis, it just feels wild. And then polar bears on the horizon. I wish they were that far away. In the first half, we saw a lot of polar bears almost every day for a while. And a couple of them right in camp. We got woken up by one that was like rubbing against our tent. We got woken up another time of one going through our garbage.
What do you do with
with Americans saying garbage, rubbish. what do we do with them? Well, all of them, as soon as they spotted us, would run away. Maybe they take a little bit of persuasion, start shouting and making ourselves look big. The one that was going through our rubbish, Jeff put his head out the door and he was like, oh man, there's a polar bear here. Go on, get, shoo. And it like ran away. And then they sort of rolled their eyes. Maybe we should go after it. And just went out and fired a flare in the air to make sure. But the one that rubbed itself against our tent just wouldn't leave. And it just stood there like completely dead still for like 5-10 minutes. We came out of the tent and we're like shouting at it, throwing stuff at it, just looking at each other like, what do we do? It is not leaving. And that was a hairy moment. But it did just eventually just turn around and very, very slowly wander away. And we have no idea why it was like that. It must have been ill or very tired. It could have eaten us all in seconds. We had a gun. But, you don't want to use that, A, because you don't want to kill a polar bear, and B, you've got to be accurate when it's 2 meters away from you.
I don't want to just get him even more angry.
I mean, when we first opened the zip, I like put the flare gun out of the tent, so it was right next to his head. And we'd fired flares in the air for polar bears before, and they'd turn tail and run. And this gun went off like next to its head, like boom, flash of light, flare flies into the sky, and it just completely unbothered.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was the last polar bear we saw, thank God. But when I say thank God, they were amazing to see, to watch them with their young, especially when we're in a kayak and they're walking along the shore. So we could see them and we're sort of traveling along with them and they're just dump-a-dump-a-dump, like lobbing along. This is just like
scary stuff. Unbelievable. A privilege at the same time. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't scared by that point when we were had the distance and we'd had the experience of what they were like. You know, initially when we did see them in the kayak and we made a noise to make them aware we were there, they got into the water. We thought that was them swimming towards us. It was actually just because their safe place is water. They're a marine mammal rather than a like a land mammal. And they'd swim by and watch us or maybe get out on the ice. So, by after a few, I wasn't necessarily scared when they were on the land and I was in the boat. But other times I was, and I was certainly, I'd say, the most scared of the team because the rest of them are used to camping or being in vicinities of apex predators, mountain lions or grizzly bears. Mm-hmm. But I'm, we've just got urban foxes in the UK. I'm just trying to get to sleep and seeing polar bears under my bed.
Yeah, badger versus polar bear. That's not much of a...
How many badges would it take?
But listen, I'm fascinated because, you know, what you're describing there, the remoteness, the isolation, the wildlife, the being so alone, even though you're in a team, you're so far away from the rest of the world. What kind of, for the rest of us who aren't adventurers and who aren't regularly putting ourselves in those kind of positions, what kind of mentality do you have to not freak out in those situations and not worry and think, I've got something to do, I need to approach this, you know, systematically and methodically and do what needs to be done? That's something that a lot of people, you know, the vast majority of people don't have. What sets adventurers apart?
One thing is just experience, mental strength. You know, nobody would ever think that you're just born with strong arms. You go to the gym, you lift weights, you put your muscles under stress, they get sore, they rip, the next day they are painful, and then they heal back stronger, and you do that incrementally until you can lift even more. So I would have been overwhelmed had you dumped me in the Arctic 15 years ago and said, like, keep calm while this dynamic sea ice rages around. And indeed, I did become overwhelmed a couple of adventures almost 10 years ago now. I failed to row the Atlantic twice. The first time, both occasions, you know, I rose to the crises that were going on around me. But equally, I look back at them and I re-examine them in through a more experienced lens. But this time, you know, I took up kayaking in COVID. I was in lots of different situations. I put myself in stressful situations on purpose. I could manufacture different kinds of stress. Like one time I took a rowing boat at 8 p.m. and I kayaked 2 kilometer strip backwards and forwards for 12 hours straight by myself in the dark. The intention was to be bored and unstimulated and mentally drained because I was doing it after work, so that I could get used to physically pushing myself when I had like no end in sight. It wasn't like if you go quicker, you finish quicker because it was 12 hours. There was nothing to do. There was nobody to talk to. Having finished work, I would have loved to have watched a movie and had a beer. So that was like stimulating a certain kind of stress. So then when I got to the Northwest Passage, on the days where it was monotonous, I could push myself physically and also switch on when I needed to, you know, come out of that stupor and go into action mode. As it was, the Northwest Passage was far less monotonous than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be a big part, but it's actually hugely varied. I loved the company of the other three. There were tough times, obviously, and team dynamics would like ebb and flow, but I don't look back and think like, well, what a boring slog parts that were. But you know, what I'm saying is mental stress is something that you become used to. So there's nothing particularly that sets me apart. I'm not like innately a hard man. I'm not even innately like athletic. I just train and I've got myself to the level where I can keep a clear head in situations that require it.
Yeah, well, very admirable stuff to be able to do that in the face of adversity and face of challenges like you have done. But have you always been an adventurer? Were you an adventurer as a kid?
Yeah, adventurous would maybe be a better description because I'm not even sure if I'm an adventurer now. I've been on one big adventure, but it's not like I spend every day in the mountains. I spend most of it parenting. But I was always outdoorsy. My family were a family of proper explorers. My dad mapped part of Patagonia. My mum had these epic adventures across the Eurasian continent. We would go camping as a family, hiking, all of these sort of things. By the time I was a teenager, all I wanted to do was play rugby. And, you know, I'd still go hiking and enjoy it, but it wouldn't be like a main part of my life. And then I went to Hong Kong for most of my 20s, lived there for almost a decade. And that's where I guess it like came core to my like lifestyle, just every weekend. adventuring, or whatever that means, hiking, kayaking, rowing. And I began to play less and less rugby. It certainly wasn't as good as I thought I was. So ending up like in the second team, not taking it as seriously until eventually the outdoors overtook rugby as a priority. You know, I mentioned rugby because it was important to me, because I think that I'm replacing it to an extent in the idea that rugby is a very physically committing sport that produces an intense level of camaraderie, which you could replace the word adventure for. You know, so people say, oh, would you do it solo and that kind of stuff? Never. You know, it is crucial to me that I have that experience of camaraderie to enjoy it, and the things we see, I want to share them. And that is very much what I got out of rugby as well. So there's like, there's no, like, did you grow up wanting to be an adventurer? There was multifaceted parents, experiences, like team sports, moving to Hong Kong, access to the outdoors, and then eventually the Northwest Passage.
Yeah. It's fascinating that whole thing around wanting to experience what you're experiencing with others, because I think you see two types of adventure and people who enjoy doing things like you have done. Those who have those personal challenges, I want to go and climb Everest, I want to go and do this and do that. And others like yourself who enjoy that challenge of working in a team. That's obviously the camp in which you sit.
I do. And that's not to say that like the external goal isn't important to me, but I guess it becomes just a facilitator rather than the overall outcome. Because, you know, let's say I wanted to share that experience and we just said, let's kayak where we feel like each day. I'm sure I would have a magical shared experience. But when does that shared experience become camaraderie? When we have a difficult goal that we're striving for together. So, you know, ipso facto, I wanted to be the first person to do the Northwest Passage by kayak, first person to do it by human power in a single year. That is an equivalent, like, I want to be on top of Everest, I want to be at the South Pole or whatever. But I wanted to do those things because it facilitates like the immense shared effort that it requires. So the extrinsic goal is still important to me. It's just a facilitator, but it's not only a facilitator. I also just, you know, I'm competitive a little bit, and I like, you know, I'm glad we succeeded. I would have been disappointed had we fallen short, but I would have at least been able to draw on the shared effort. But you know, so it's like, again, it's not as simple as a one. I've got multi-dimensional motivations, I guess, but the core ones are immersion in nature and camaraderie, and I feel like those ones bring you more lasting contentment than just an outcome and expecting to feel different than when you cross an arbitrary place or stand on the top of an arbitrary mountain.
Yeah, of course. What's your relationship like, and has it been like throughout your life, with danger and adrenaline? Because obviously there's elements of danger in what you do and the things that you've taken on. Has that always sat comfortably with you?
For one thing, I wouldn't say it's like an adrenaline, because it's very, very slow, you know, incredibly slow. It's 103 days. It's 10 hours slowly. There's no like, there was only one moment where it was like, focus, we need to surf these waves, we need to heart pumping anaerobic stuff. I wouldn't compare myself to like a base jumper, and as a result the risks are less like in your face, I suppose. It's not like I've got 3 seconds to pull this, so I'm dead. It happens all slowly out there. So, you know, so in a sense, like, the danger element isn't, I'm not there for the excitement of danger, of like, you know, I felt more alive when I've died kind of thing. You know, I'd rather not be in those situations. It's more about slowly moving through nature under my own power. And by doing it under my own power, it makes me an extension of the place around it rather than like powering through it on a motor. You know, you feel the tide, you feel the changes in wind. In fact, there was even a day specifically quite late on where we were having a tough time. And I just felt the wind change a tiny bit. And I wouldn't have perceived that at the beginning of the trip, but I did on day, whatever it was, 80. And that was the joy of being immersed in nature and being an extension of it and being a subject to it, and living in it so closely. Those are the things you get from moving slowly rather than like the excitement of almost dying. You just don't really contemplate it, I suppose. There was one day where I really thought, like, God, this is selfish what I've done, because we almost died. And, you know, you think about, you know, it's like, you don't know how close your eye, almost dying, but two bits of ice like slammed into either side of my kayak. And instead of crushing us, it picked us up. And who knows if it had been slightly heavier or we'd leaning to the right or the left, or leaning forward or put an arm out instinctively, that kind of thing, it could have just crushed us and powdered us. So it was after that I thought, like, I've got to get home because I have kids. So my relationship with danger is that I'm not like really an adrenaline junkie. I'm more like a immersion in nature junkie, I suppose.
Sure. I think if I was going to join you, I think that would be the route I'd take. I think I don't think I'd be throwing myself off anything.
Yeah.
Seeking adrenaline, but I'd much rather I would take the slow approach.
I'm so pathetic sound on mountain biking. Sometimes people say, oh, do you want to come? And I think it sounds fun. And then I'm just like squeaking on the brakes as I go down the hill, like, no, I don't want to go fast. They're like, just go over the jump. If you commit to it, then it's easier to land. All right, I want to go over the jump. So that's like an indication of where my enjoyment lies.
I haven't been skiing for very many, many years before I had kids. But I remember going when I was quite young and kind of being, quite low to the ground and quite fearless then because I'd piling down the hill. I remember the last time I went as an adult, that had all gone. I remember spending the whole week being pretty much terrified everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You just I remember that exact experience with skiing. I used to just go off this particular jump at this dry ski slope in my house. I looked at the jump as an adult and I was like, that is insane.
Now, I've had a look at a little bit of on your website at some of the stuff you've taken on, and I was interested to see ultra running down there as something that you took on. Obviously, that is a solo sport anyway, but you said that really helps you to build mental strength. So I'm interested about that. And also, but obviously, clearly, there's something about water that pulls you back to the kayak as well. So interesting to pick up on those two points. Ultra running, first of all.
So ultra running in Hong Kong, again, it's got one of the biggest ultra running communities in the world. And most of the country, like 40% of the country, is these big country parks, these beautiful mountains, as tall as Ben Nevis, some of them, and is much steeper. And it's become sort of normal out there. I mean, even if you're not, quote-unquote, an ultra runner, you might do the Moon Trekker, which is 40-something kilometers, or the Makalos is 100 kilometers through the mountains is like a one-off with your work team or whatever. Just being surrounded by that, I always wanted to do it. And I was putting it off because I was trying to row the Atlantic at the time. I didn't want to injure myself. When I got back from the Atlantic on the second time, and I was absolutely devastated for having failed again, it's a complete spiral. I thought that I wasn't resilient enough and that was what was wrong with me. And I needed to build resilience again. I've subsequently realized that my problem was that I was focusing too much on the outcome and not enough on the experience. And the true resilience is, whether I succeed or fail, I judge success on my own terms as camaraderie and immersion in nature. But at the time, I thought I needed to become like a bit more hardcore. And certainly that is important if you're doing these things. And what I went through as an ultra runner helped. Although I wouldn't say I'm an ultra runner. I did a handful of ultra marathons and I probably never will again. But
if you do one ultra marathon, you're an ultra marathon runner. So
I've done some ultra marathons, there was one in particular, the Hong Kong 100. I really targeted and I trained too much, and my knee blew out like 6 kilometers in, and I like limped like sideways. I couldn't bend my left leg for like 90 something kilometers, and it took a very long time. And I was just thinking, like, I'm not quitting again. I'm not quitting again. I'm not quitting again. And that was, a big turning point in my like road to re-finding my identity and equilibrium as just like proof. Like, you walked like there was sand in your kneecap for 24 hours, 96 kilometers, 5,000 meters of total elevation. Like, you're not a pathetic quitter. You have emphatic evidence. And I really needed that at the time. I really, really needed that. Yeah. And equally, you say it's not a team sport. Hong Kong is weird. I thought this was normal because I was introduced to ultra running in Hong Kong, where I subsequently found out it is not. They do it in teams. They're like not in relays. There's a number of races there you can do in pairs or fours. And I did the Moon Trekker, which is another one with a four. And I was particularly fit at the time. And maybe my time would have been quicker or not with them by myself. But it wasn't about that again. It was like four of us, and we walked and we talked and we stopped and we chatted in checkpoints and we ate. And nobody was like there to prove how resilient they were or whatever, and that was a wonderful experience. What brings me back to the water, I would say that nothing. I'd say my primary enjoyment is hiking.
Okay.
So, and then probably followed by kayaking now. I had a fantastic adventure the summer before last where I kayaked down the west coast of Scotland and stopped at Munro's that I passed them and hiked up them. And that was probably the ultimate. I just love walking through hills, and I get the same thing that I get out of archery running, but without any of the, like, the knee pain. So I'd love to do some beautiful hikes, and I like kayaks as well because it's relatively, like, low logistics. Like, I'm so admin averse, and the planning it takes to go through the Norfolk Passage or such, and the what it cost me mentally and literally to achieve that is, like, almost not worth it. Like, I can't imagine starting that journey again if I wanted to be the first person that kayak around something else. So I'm like, well, I own kayaks. I live in the UK. So admin low to just put it on the roof of my car and go and have an adventure, and even less for hiking. So yeah, there's nothing in particular that brings me back to water. It just happened to be hiking. It happened to be kayaking this time. I don't say I'm a kayaker. I don't say I'm a hiker. I don't say I'm a... I had this argument when I was, like, as a time passing exercise, when me and some friends rode from Newcastle to Orkney, and I was trying to say I'm not a rower, and they were like, exhibit A, you know, you're rowing boats and rowing for 24 hours a day. I was like, yeah, I just happen to be rowing now, but I might never row again for all, you know, like, you know. And so it's, yeah, there's nothing in particular that brings me back.
Yeah, that's fair enough. It's interesting what you said, though, because I spoke to a chap called Nick Ray. You might have heard of him.
Amazing. Wherever he went each day, which is, I thought about him specifically when I was saying earlier, like, would I get my experience of camaraderie if I just kayaked and picked up each day where to go? Completely different adventure. Like, such a fantastic idea. And I wish I was that zen just to, like, go with the flow. But I think I need a goal.
Yeah, but you both sound very similar in terms of that, wanting that connection with nature, and that kayaking gives that to you. So I might spend more than half an hour on the Basingstoke Canal, because it sounds like, you know, you both painted quite an idyllic picture of what it's like.
Well, I guess, why would I like kayaking against another water sport like rowing, which I used to do more of? Is kayaks are so intimate with the water. You know, you feel every ripple, and you like you're keeping your knees soft in skiing, so they, like, go with each bump in your body, so it stays like a gyro. You get that, but I guess in your hips. And you can, unlike a rowing boat, which is wide oars and whatnot, you could nip in and out and over very, very shallow rocks. You can really, literally be in the coastline and see it from a perspective that's amazing. I kayaked for a mile, and, you know, I like gently going along these cliffs, and then just in this gully, this huge waterfall pouring off, and stopped and looked at it. And I have a friend who has a rib, like a motorboat, and he goes around Mull all the time, and he's trying to tell me, where's that? I've never seen that before. It's like, yeah, because I was in a kayak. I just came across it. You probably zoomed past it in the split second that you opened that opening of the gully was next to you. You weren't looking. So that's why I like kayaking as opposed to, say, rowing. Well, now I like rowing. Maybe I'll row again, but, like, kayaking is the peak of water sports for me. And then hiking is, like, for similar reasons, but none of them have
sounds great. I'm gonna have to get back on the canal. I want to talk a little bit about, you've mentioned it already, the Atlantic crossings in 2016 and 2018, and I know they ended in disappointment for you, and you've touched on that already about the, you know, the impact that had on you. Do you mind telling me a bit more about that in terms of what your hopes were and how they weren't realized in the end?
Well, I guess the first one, I like did a paper place, you know, like a captain was selling spots on his boat, and he was trying to set the world record. And it was something that I hadn't contemplated before. I didn't know that people set world records in adventure. You know, I knew there were firsts, but not like speed records. But, and as soon as I heard that, you know, I was really excited about it. And we included it in my sponsorship pitch, you know, sponsor us and you'll be associated with world record holders. And I think I just internalized that too much and sort of began to believe the sponsorship pitch, and that became the outcome I was looking for. I wanted to do it really with my friend Stu from school and have this amazing experience, like, in the middle of the Atlantic, and I just completely forgot about it. So my outcomes were not met because they became utterly binary about setting a world record or not, or even at least crossing the Atlantic or not. But we got rescued within like 2 days, and I suppose had I been focused on intrinsic enjoyment of being in in nature. I would have still considered 2 days a bit of a failure. And then the second one was like 3 days and 5 days by the time we were picked up, equally embarrassing. And by that point, we were trying to set the mixed pair world record, and it all become about these world records. And and then when I on the back of that got myself back on my feet, it was all about, right, well, you know, what's next? Well, the Northwest Passage is something I've been thinking about for years, and now there's this guy trying to do it, and I want to join his team. And you know, the redemption of being the first to do this, having failed at the Atlantic records, will be immense. That will be redemption. And then over that journey, I began to realize that that's not redemption. Like, being an adventurer is about the adventure, not the finish line. So I guess like why I was so disappointed is because, you know, the narrative I held as to a reason why I was doing this was just like binary. And, you know, even if I had achieved them, and sooner or later I would have not set a world record or not finished or whatever. That's the point in doing something hard, the edge of your ability. So yeah, that's how my outcomes are not met. There's a particular piece of psychology that was said that there's only three reasons why people do sport: performance, discovery, and relationships. And the performance one was where I'd become obsessed with, and I'd forgotten that it was about the discovery and the relationships.
Well, I don't think anyone reading your story and reading that and reading, you know, what you attempted and sort of appreciating what you tried to do crossing the Atlantic would ever have said, ever thought that, you know, that was a failure anyway, because achieving even 2 or 3 days to, you know, trying to do that, for me, that's incredible. And I'll take my hat off to you for even attempting something like that. But you wrote on the website that you felt humiliated and pathetic. And that really struck me, because obviously I doubt any of your loved ones or your friends would have said anything even remotely similar to you once you got back. They're probably all incredibly proud of what you had achieved. But for you, clearly, that was something that you took it incredibly personally.
Yeah, I guess the humiliation part, you know, everybody thinks they're the center of the universe. And the reality is nobody else is thinking of you as much as you're thinking of you. And whenever I saw somebody wrote the Atlantic and set a record or whatever and get in the newspaper, I sort of imagined everybody else who knew me reading it and going, oh, another person's wrote the Atlantic. It must be, what happened with Mark? I mean, why? This is clearly so easy. But really, people were probably looking at that and thinking about the story they were reading, and I wasn't crossing their mind at all, you know. So that's like making,
you know,
glad I'm alive. They probably just weren't thinking about me. I mean, you think that everybody is like thinking about you, but they're not. And you know, now that I've like realized that, I mean, just something like public speaking, people are like, what if I embarrass myself? Nobody will think about you ever again. Like, you're not as important as you think you are, and that is liberating. So that's the humiliation part. And you mentioned friends in particular, like so much of my self-worth had become tied up in the idea of being an adventurer that I just re-examined my conversations with friends, and I just, oh God, were they bored with me? Was I speaking too much? You know, that's that kind of social anxiety that you get. I had that like in the extreme, because I was just so worthless. I couldn't imagine my friends seeing worth in me. And if I articulated that, even at the time, I'd say, my friends don't like me. I'd say, of course they like me. But for some reason, just like it was all spiraling. So I just felt utterly pathetic and like humiliated. And
did you feel
and self-indulgent?
Sorry, presumably, you know, you your friends and loved ones afterwards, though, you know, were full of praise and admiration for you. Did you feel that they weren't being genuine at that point, and that the for you the overriding feeling was that, you know, I've let them down? Is that how?
No, because it became more systemic than that. It wasn't like I came out of conversations and thought, wow, my friends must be internally laughing at the idea of me failing the Atlantic. It was just like they must be bored of me. Yeah, like I didn't think that I'd have a couple of pints and then wake up in the morning going, I bet while I was talking about, you know, who's going to win the Six Nations, Will was having an internal monologue that this is the guy who failed the Atlantic. I'd just be thinking, was I talking too much about the Six Nations? Because they must be bored of me. Like, you know, it just became like, you know, at the core of myself, something must be wrong. I must be boring. I must be worthless. I must be a dour. Like, oh, I used to be so much fun. I used to be like, banter was so easy. And I'd see them having like an easy, funny conversation, taking the mick out of each other. And I think, I used to do that. Why don't I do that anymore? And maybe, I probably was doing that. Like, so it wasn't so much that I was like, it just became so systemic that it was beyond like thinking about them laughing at me about the Atlantic and just thinking about everybody just sort of being a bit over me.
Yeah. So how did you pull yourself up and out of that then? Because that must be difficult to be sort of lost in your own head in that sense. How did you pull yourself up and out?
Trail running and ultra running was a big step in that. Partly because I have no hope of being good at ultra running. I'm like a quite big guy. I'm better, you know, you'd look at me and you'd assume I was a rugby player or a rower, not like a sprightly ultra running man going through the mountains. So that was good because I could just do it and finish and push myself and maybe set like my own goal. But there was like literally no hope of me doing well. You know, so when I did the Hong Kong 100, that one that was so important to me, my personal goal was 24 hours. And even with my knee bust, I finished in under 24 hours. The winner does it in 10. Like, you know, it's like, so like that is sort of a remove from myself, my like instead of pressure and allowed myself to enjoy it again. I was just out in nature and also doing hard stuff and reminding myself that I could. And then that piece of psychology that I briefly mentioned before about performance, discovery, and relationship, that was just like a light bulb moment. I was like, oh yeah, discovery and relationships. When did I forget about that? And it wasn't supposed to be self-help. It was it's just a piece of psychology to explain like why people do sport. And I just was like, yeah, that is why I do sport. wouldn't I forget that? And it was such a turning point. And soon after reading that, I went on a kayaking adventure in Hong Kong. And apart from pottering around a little bit, on rivers here and there, and a little bit when I was much, much younger, I'd never really done anything. And this was supposed to be training for a race in Canada that I was signed up to that was going to be my next, like, now I've done the Hong Kong 100, let's do a big kayaking race. And that'll be my next, like, proof that I can finish and get, like, hardiness and whatnot. And that got cancelled because of COVID, but I committed to this 5-day training with my friends. So we did it, and I thought it was just going to be about, you know, physically pushing yourself and whatnot. And, you know, having never got on a kayak more than pottering around here and there, we got in, did 42 kilometers that day, that few days exploring these islands. On the way back, these waves that, you know, felt immense. The whole thing felt really committing. And, you know, now I'm more experienced in kayaking. I probably would like cruise through that. But at the time I was like, I'm on the verge of whatever. And, you know, came around the headland, finally, after 2 hours of fighting and kayaking as hard as I could to stay like upright in this, into shallow, calm water. And I was just, that was like the moment where, with the framework in mind, I was like, discovery and relationships. This is adventure. I am an adventurer. Which I now look back on cringe. I don't know what an adventurer means, but it was like the moment where I was like, I'm immersed in nature. I'm pushing myself. I'm moving through the environment under my own power, and I'm sharing it with my friend. And this is a stretch of water that is not famous, or it's not a first, it's not a fast record or whatever, but it is an adventure. And so it was a slow moving process, but that was like a big old turning point. But that's not to say that I'd say that it's never gone away. Really, when you open yourself up to that level of negativity, and I can sometimes be triggered by a couple of things, you know, even if somebody from one of the old rowing teams messages me, like with my profile sort of sometimes provokes an angry message, yeah. Especially as I talk about it, and they say, well, that's not what happened and whatnot. And I get annoyed with myself that I'm like, I thought I was beyond this, but I'm spiraling all over again.
Yeah. It's something to do with pressure, isn't it? That self-imposed pressure that we all put on ourselves to feel like we have to succeed in something and do something, you know, that society expects of us or whatever that might be. Quite often when you step back from that, you realize actually that's the only person putting that pressure on is me.
Mm.
Sort of step away from that and just enjoy the experience, and it gives you a completely different take on it all. Let's come back to the Northwest Passage. Tell me a little bit about how you met the team and how the actual challenge sort of came about in the first place.
So yeah, initially I think I read a book called The Man Who Ate His Boots, which is about Northwest Passage. That got me excited. At the same time, I was planning on my first Atlantic crossing, and I was researching all different things ocean rowing related, and I saw somebody talking about rowing the Northwest Passage, and that was the moment. And I was like, yes, here we go. And then that came to fruition. I saw that guy a few years later posted about trying to row the Northwest Passage, so I signed up to his team, and things were... you know, I would have done things differently on the rowing team. So that very late on, I decided that maybe it wasn't the team for me. And I dropped out and called this kayaking team, who are our rivals. They tried in 2022 and hadn't got very far in singles. And they thought they could solve some of their problems by coming back in doubles. So I knew that they needed an extra person. And we spoke, and they accepted me onto the team, which was a big risk for them because they have ultra kayaking CVs as long as my arm, of like records and championships and of 600 kilometers this and 3 days of staying awake that, and including kayaking down the Amazon west. The expedition leader and friend Jeff were the first people to kayak sea to source, or source to sea, and another one down the Volga. So, you know, and I had general outdoors experience, but certainly not that much kayaking experience. There's a big risk for them. You have to ask them whether they think it paid off or they regret it. But because of my investment in the rowing team, I was quite low on cash, so I couldn't even afford to go to America to train with them. So when I flew to the Arctic to kayak the Northwest Passage with these three people, that's the first time I met them.
Really? That was the first time you met them? Goodness me.
You know, big hug in the hotel. Good to meet you. Let's go to the Arctic together.
Wow. So what were you, obviously having had the disappointment of the previous team and left that, what were you hoping that the dynamic was going to be for this team that would mean that you'd be able to do it, basically? What were you looking for in your teammates?
Well, I thought they would start, and there was only four, the two of them were best friends, and four just seemed like more manageable team dynamic than eight. And by that point, I guess part of it was just, I was like, I've got to do this. And, I was, the rowing team had been delayed and delayed, and, they did start. They were one of the teams that we beat. So fair play to them for starting. Having done it and completed it and, beaten the other two teams, I don't want to like sound like I'm gloating too much, because I'm sure they had a great adventure and saw some fantastic things, and I hope they did. They had some good friends on board there, and I wouldn't like to say anything that suggests that I was leaving for I don't know, it's difficult to say without like sounding like I'm being gloating about the fact that we won in the end. I'm really happy that they got there. My friend Davey on board was a great guy, and spoken to him, and it sounds like they had some fantastic experiences. And it was a bit of a gamble for me. I was supposed to go with people I'd never met, but ultimately it was a gamble that paid off, for me at least. Whether it paid off for them, you know, it's for them to say, but I think that we all had a fantastic time, and I look forward to having a beer with them in like a week or a year or 10 years and being like, remember that sunset, remember those narwhals, and that is like what really means a lot to me.
What made you a strong team, and what is the essence of a strong team then? For to spend as long as you did, 102 days with those people, what made that special, and what made you achieve everything?
Well, I guess there's sort of two kinds of team cohesion. There's task cohesion and there's social cohesion. You know, social cohesion is how well you get along as a group, and task cohesion is how likely that group is to finish an expedition, and they're not necessarily linked. You know, you could have a group of best friends who have no chance of kayaking the Northwest Passage, or you could have a group of like serious kayakers who hate each other. And ultimately, those things are linked. Definitely tensions are higher when we're stuck on shore for 10 days, or tension is higher when it's like ambiguity about whether the conditions were like good enough to go out or somebody wasn't feeling safe. When we started moving, the tension dissipates immediately and everything's all good. So social cohesion is linked to task cohesion. The more likely you are to achieve a task, of course, the more likely you are to get along. And I'd say that is what we had in common, is like, no matter what was happening, no matter what team dynamics were like fluctuating at any given time, we all shared this iron will to finish. And we basically never discussed as a group like finishing. We discussed maybe picking up more food if we had to, or how that would happen. We never ever discussed finishing. And ultimately that's like the bedrock of our task cohesion, which led to our social cohesion, because like, had somebody been saying, you know, even like, hey guys, I think we should discuss an exit plan and just give ourselves, you know, maybe a date that we don't go beyond or something like that. You know, even if I had been sensible, he would have eaten at the camaraderie and getting along. So, you know, I think the absolute bedrock was four utterly, utterly determined people who overcame so much together. You know, Jeff, 63, completely sapped his Achilles tendon to wow. finished, you know, and he snapped it like a third of the way through. Wow. You know, that's the kind of like, that is the depth that we were going to for each other. It's just so much respect for everybody. And equally, like, you know, West was a leader and he'd like ultimately have a call, but it was a lot of times where he did it very differently to how I would have done it, but there was equally a lot of times where he carefully listened and then say, you know, I've heard you and I think that you're right. Let's just do 5 miles tomorrow to set up for the crossing, for example. For sure. I mean, in the first half, or I would have done lots of things differently. But when push came to shove, and when we were balancing a tightrope at the end between trying to go as fast as we can to get there before winter comes, with not just pushing and getting summit fever and going out in conditions that weren't acceptable, an impossible line to balance, and one which is ultimately like deadly if you get wrong, and expedition ruining if you get wrong the other way. West was sensible, and that's where I really think he came into his own in the last 3 weeks, like not being like subject to an ego of like, well, I just go out and finish this, it's just 40 miles to the end, we could just do it, you know, 40 miles or 5 miles or 2 miles, like if you go over in the Arctic it's game over. So, you know, those last few weeks I think he like grew into this very, very sensible adventurer leader.
That's what you need from a leader, isn't it?
That, yeah, exactly.
A clear head in the
I was absolutely like, particularly, I'm just going through my diary at the moment because I'm writing a book, and like those last few days I was just so depleted, and I'd been basically doing the navigation from about a third of the way through, and I was I pat myself on the back. I think I was very good at it, and I saved a lot of, you know, cumulatively a lot of miles. It would have been days by going in straight lines or navigating through fog, which is very confusing, and you know, that's not just me, that's Eileen who's steering, and I'm giving you instructions to, and we sort of develop this perfect, you know, little bit right. And you begin to know after weeks of doing this what a little bit right means. But in those, even in those last few days, I was just like mentally in a fog where I just couldn't. I was just trying to look after myself, like let her actually navigate. So there was days where I was, you know, sending us in the wrong direction. We constantly having to readjust. So, you know, to have the capacity to do that as West did, and also that's just an example, I'm meaning, of like where how. It's not just physical, your mental energy is sapped. And I'm sure West had his mental energy sapped too. But in those last few days, he was saying, like, we could go, let's not go. We can go, let's not go. And he became more conservative. And maybe we could have gone when we didn't go a few times. But, like, that's the other side to be on. Like, and so that was the leadership coming to fruition in the end. And I mean, I would have made a lot of different decisions in the first half. But, like, you know.
But you did it.
Eternal respect to everybody for all they brought. You know, the hardiness, the decision making, the like the unquestioning like dedication to chores in the morning. We all bought something. But we all bought different thing. But you know what makes a good team? Like the iron will that we all had in common, like to finish this. Until we ran out of food, I think that would be the only thing that stopped us, and we very, very nearly did. You know, we're like 89 miles from the end, with no weather window for 10 days, with about 7 days of food. another weather window appeared and we snatched at it. And it was like stealing days from the Arctic. It was telling us you're no longer welcome here. And we finished with like hours worth of food, And that probably would have been the only team that could stop us. And even if then, I don't know what we would have done. It's not like we could say, well, you know, game over. Let's pick up your baggage on the left and go home. You know, we would have been out of food. Like, I don't know what we would have done. But nobody spoke about it because we shared an iron will. And that iron will, that task cohesion then filters into social cohesion on a macro scale. Of course, on like a day-to-day basis, there were days where people were sick of each other. That's just the nature of it.
Yeah, of course. But tell me about the finish and that last day. I'm assuming there wasn't a finish line. What was there? How did you know you got to the end point? And what was
there
that
is
last
a
day
line.
Like? Okay, right.
Northwest Passage is defined by the Canadian government and the Hydro something mapping organization, who are like the people, like the authority, and they have a latitude and a longitude that's like the end of the Northwest Passage, Baffin Bay to Beaufort Sea. And this is, again, West's preparation. He was like researching this until the nth degree, so he knew exactly where it was. But other people sort of wish-washingly define it as somewhere from Tuktaatten to Pond Inlet. And by this definition, Pond Inlet is actually 40 miles short. So, you know, there is somebody who's done it over 3 years, where we're the first people to do it in human power. In one go, 3 years in a rowing boat. Some people would say, well, he hasn't done it, he did 40 miles short. I mean, but equally, like, it's a concept. It's not like something that's rooted in physical geography. You know, if you kayak around an island, there's an island and you start and you finish in the same place. Like, there's
same
no
point.
So it's a concept. And some sailors would say it has to be from Arctic Circle to Arctic Circle, because if it's the link in the Atlantic to the Pacific. But we decided, and Guinness Records define it as completely randomly. Like, I've never heard of anybody who agrees with their definition. And the countless people who've been trying this under human power for the last 10 years have not tried to do the Guinness record one. It's just random. A bizarre organization who seem to be the governing body of who can fit the most cigarettes in your mouth in the maritime definition of Northwest Passage.
It's a bit random.
So there was a finishing. We knew we'd get past get Cape Brathurst, and then we finished. And we had this terrifying last few minutes where the waves are breaking. The conditions we would never have gone out in before, but we found themselves in them unexpectedly for the last like 30 seconds. We had to surf down them, and Eileen like expertly steering on the pedals behind me, and me communicating with her and using my rudder as an extra rudder as well. We're using my paddle as an extra rudder as we surf down these waves. Like, left, right, move. Okay, here comes one. Big push. They shot out into the calm water. And that moment, I just lost it. I started to cry and cry, my shoulders shaking with tears, trying to say to Eileen, like, we've done it. I just couldn't speak. I was crying so much. It meant so much to me. I thought of my wife, thought of everything it had taken me to get to the start, everything we'd been through together, and like the pressure. You know, I wasn't outcome focused. I was thinking about the experience. But in the last few days where, you know, it was so close and the weather was getting like worse and worse, it you know, the pressure was building and building. It was just release. And I thought about players at Wimbledon hitting their winning shot and then collapsing onto the grass and like sobbing as they realized they won Wimbledon. It felt like that.
Did that notion take you by surprise? Did you kind of anticipate that you'd feel that way, or was it complete surprise?
I knew I'd be happy and I knew it would be catharsis, but the like speed and intensity of it was immense, especially given that we were still like days away from actually finishing. You know, it wasn't like we could just exit on the left. So we had to die for another few days. And then I was relieved that we finished, but I was relieved that we finished when we actually finished, but not like that moment of just sheer joy.
Sure. Did it feel a little bit like you were putting the demon to rest, if you like, in terms of the disappointment of the Atlantic crossings and all that you went through in the wake of that? Did this feel a little bit like, right, you can park that now, draw a line under that, move on? Was it?
Yeah.
Was that in your mind?
So, yeah, like I say, you know, I was trying to be journey focused instead of outcome focused. And had I failed like 500 miles short, 1,000 miles short, I would think I would have been like, well, you know, I've learned my lessons from the Atlantic, that this is not about the outcome, it's about the adventure. And I've seen ice, and I've seen polar bears, and I've had a great experience, and we tried our best, and they're all very content. But like, we get so close to the end, I'm like, I can't fail again. I can't fail again. I'm just 89 miles from the end. I can't fail again. 89 miles sounds like an arbitrary number, but when we were 89 miles out from the end, we just had one more crossing, and the weather wasn't playing ball, and it felt like everything was slipping away from us. And we didn't take a weather window that we maybe should have taken. And I gave myself too much credit that I thought maybe I should have advocated more for us going on that weather window. And I began to really self-flagellate, and that felt very similar to like, I can't, you took the easy option out again, was like the internal monologue that I once had at the Atlantic. And now I was having to get to that moment. I was utterly, that was just grim. That was so close and so far. So then to finish, it did feel like redemption, you know, redemption. We'd done it, but finished, you know. Obviously, we cut to the end, but I almost thought, like, I don't even care if we get rescued now. Like, nobody can take this away from us.
And being named European Adventure of the Year, you're joining the likes of Felix Baumgartner, the guy you jumped from space. Who can forget that? That was incredible. And Kilian Jornet, who's someone I follow closely because I can't believe some of the things that he does and some of the places he runs and the mountains he runs and so on and so forth. Incredible individuals, and now you're amongst their ranks. That must feel incredible.
Yeah, it does. It feels pretty amazing. I mean, I am a sports journalist. I've interviewed Kilian Jornet, and now I'm like also a European Adventurer of the Year. Kilian is so impressive, and with so many awards, that he doesn't even list the European Adventurer of the Year on his website among his other accolades. What do I feel about European Adventure of the Year? It makes it tangible in a way, because even though the Northwest Passage, if I say I'm the first person to do the Northwest Passage, I usually have to explain what it is. But now I can say I'm European Adventure of the Year, I don't have to explain it. So it's like nice. But as I say, the redemption that I feel is that I've like remembered why I enjoy it. And like, I guess I would differentiate between two mutually exclusive feelings. Pride, yeah, and contentment. A lot of people might have said, oh, I'm very proud to have done the Northwest Passage, but you know, it was not as fun as I thought it was going to be, or like, I'm already planning the next thing, I wish I was still out there, or whatnot. But I'm also content. So I'm thinking, I am so proud we did it, and I'm so content with how it felt to do it. So, how does it feel to be European Adventure of the Year? It feeds into the pride, but doesn't necessarily feed into the contentment. The contentment is drawn from the epic experiences we had and the people I shared it with, and the pride will last, I suppose. But I'll European Adventure of the Year 2023. Somebody will be 2024, and somebody will be 2034, and I'll be European Adventure of the Year 11 years ago. But you know, I'll always be able to have a drink with Eileen, West, or Jeff. And
indeed,
that's what's special.
And just talking about that contentment, does that therefore mean that there's nothing else in the pipeline for you at the moment, or is there something that's on your radar?
Adventure's going to be a huge part of my life forever. And I would love to do big things in the UK. I'm writing a book called Stay Ventures, where I'm trying to make the point that you're not limited in the UK. It doesn't have to be small. So, and interviewing some inspiring people who've done big things here. And I don't know what my big thing will be. And having had a baby 10 weeks ago and another one these 20 months, it might not be big for a while, but it will eventually be. I just feel like the UK is... People seem disappointed. You've done the Northwest Passage. I thought you were going to do something bigger and better. I'm like, well, it could be. If you cut like a hole around the British mainland, that's actually further than the Northwest Passage. It's actually longer. What do you want? If my focus is on immersive experiences and shared experiences, then I'm sort of liberated from looking for like something like Everest or the South Pole or whatever. I can do something that I enjoy, which is still epic and big. Prior in the UK, and I spoke before about how overwhelming and I find the admin. It reduces a huge amount of that as well.
Sure. Mark, thank you. I really appreciate you taking so much of your afternoon to talk to us. It's been fascinating. You're an inspiration, and I'm certainly going to have to try and have a bit more time on the kayak, I think, on the Basingstoke Canal next time.
I think I need a little less time on the kayak.
Well, when you've got two kids under two, that in itself is an adventure. So best of luck with that.
Thank you. But,
Mark, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. That's it for this episode and for this season. Thanks to Mark Agnew for taking us into the Arctic and through the Northwest Passage. If you want to find out more about Mark's life and his remarkable adventures, you'll find the links to his website and socials in the show notes. You'll also find our episode question there too. And this time we're asking, what's been the biggest adventure of your life? Our yes-no poll, meanwhile, asks, have you ever achieved something unforgettable as part of a team? You can answer both on the Spotify episode page, the link to which can be found in the episode notes, through the Linktree site in the show profile, or the Bravefront website. As ever, you can also interact with the show by sending us a voice message, so tell us what you think of our guests and the subjects we're discussing. You can also tell us your ideas for topics and things you'd like us to cover in the next season too. Again, just head to the episode notes, Linktree site, or the Bravefront website for more details and all the links you need to do so. And finally, if you've enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and follow us on whatever platform you usually get your podcast. Every review and every follow helps others to find the show. In the meantime, though, thanks for listening. We'll be back with season 2 in a few weeks' time. And until then, take care.